Hi, Bobby Halton here for our friends at Unimac. There's no price you can put on a life, including our own. Being proactive with our health and safety is non-negotiable. To protect against cancer-causing carcinogens, you need more than just clean gear. You need a total solution with the best equipment, the best technology, and the best training. That's why Unimac partnered with an NFPA-authorized independent service provider to offer certified training on NFPA 1851 standards. When it comes to keeping us and our fellow firefighters safe and healthy, demand the total package. Get the details at unimac.com/protect.
Welcome back to Main Street Firefighting, a podcast by Fire Engineering. I'm Lex Shady, along with my partner, Chris Tobin. Before we get started, we'd again like to thank Fire Engineering for this opportunity and you all for listening in. We hope this project brings a greater awareness to the Main Street buildings in your area. Tonight, we have a very special guest, Assistant Chief Joe Pernesti with the Elyria, Ohio Fire Department. Chief Pernesti has over 32 years in the fire service and has experienced Main Street fires firsthand. Chief is also very active with Fire Engineering, from writing many different articles to instructing at FDIC and his own podcast series, In Their Own Words. Chief Pernesti has been a great resource and mentor to both Chris and I, and we would not be here hosting this podcast if it weren't for him. We're very excited to have him on tonight and hope you enjoy this interview. Chief, before we dig into this fire, can you give our listeners a little bit of a rundown on your city and the building stock that we're looking at here?
Yeah, the city of Elyria, Ohio, it's in the northern part of the state. It's halfway between Cleveland and Toledo, and it's probably one of the larger cities between the two. So we were founded in 1817, and because there's a river that runs through town, a lot of industry came and started to build. The height of our city as far as industry was probably like anywhere else, in the 20s and 30s during the war, World War II. And we have lots of large buildings, lots of large industry, and a typical old Midwestern city. And we have, our homes are predominantly balloon frame. I tell people, you won't find much truss construction in my town. It's starting to sprout up now with the dollar stores and those kind of things. But it's an old city. It's a small Cleveland, Ohio, is basically how I say it. It's a small urban, economically depressed city now.
So it's interesting you say that, to where you have an urban element and maybe not so much of an urban esque, I guess, a fire department response, and that's kind of putting you in that very, very thin layer of departments across the country that really have an urban fire problem, but maybe not necessarily an urban fire department response. So you got to kind of switch things up sometimes and adapt to that.
Yeah, you know, I guess this is a little bit of bragging, but for a city our size, we do a fair amount of work. But we have a lot of unusual things that have happened in our town for a city our size. We're 21 square miles. I would say we probably have dropped in population. I think the last census we were at 53,000, but when I started 32 years ago, we were probably closer to 60,000 people. Most of the population in my county is heading towards east, towards Cleveland, in the smaller communities of Lorain County that are building up. So we have a lot of old, you know, like I mentioned, a lot of old dwellings and shrinking population. And it's a working person's town is the best way to describe Elyria, Ohio.
Sure. And that makes sense. You said, you know, mentioned the work aspect. The work always follows the buildings and the socioeconomics of that, which basically when all those things line up, in your case, we have an older building stock we have some migration away from a place, which leaves a lower socioeconomic level of people there. And we all know behaviors is what starts fires, not buildings. It's a people problem, not a building problem.
We have a lot of houses that we just have a lot of houses that were single family dwellings in the, you know, in the beginning of the century, in the early 1900s. And when in the 50s, 60s and 70s, you know, those families moved away or died. And we have a ton of houses that have been split up into multifamily dwellings that were on a single family plan.
Right.
And we have a large downtown in my city. The downtown was the every place, the epicenter of life in the from the beginning of 1900 to 1966 exactly, because we built a large indoor mall in 1966. And from that period on, our downtown, which was truly the main street, it's called Broad Street, where you went for everything, it just died out from the 60s and till now. There's a lot of vacant buildings, but there's also a lot of attempts at development.
And that's the thing, is when you have a developer that comes in, or just a broad initiative to gentrify an area, you know, those socioeconomics start to improve, but then obviously the fire goes down. I mean, all that's very correlated. We know that from studies, and you can see that across the country. Where the fastest growing cities have the lightest weight buildings, but also have the highest socioeconomics, and they have a very low number, almost to the point of a non-existent fire rate. So then we have your very specific city you're in now that falls inside that bracket of older building stock, you know, a lower socioeconomic demographic, and you're going to see work, and that's something that we see across the country.
So. Yeah, we have a lot of, just good, they're good people working very hard, but transient, you know, the renters going from one house to another or one apartment to another. But we have a lot of beautiful buildings too, and that's a good thing that we have that. And like you said, we have developers that want to come in and redo these buildings, as the one that we're talking about today, as far as where the fire occurred.
Sure. Where you're working at is, it sounds like it's a really good place to be, you know, a fireman at. And I think you're just going to basically see that trend continue for your fire duty.
Been very lucky. It's a fun town to work in.
Can you just start off with telling us kind of what happened that night, how that call came in?
Yeah, we got the call about 7:54 p.m. For smoke in the area of our downtown. The first arriving boss, the shift commander, was an acting assistant chief. He's a captain, very knowledgeable, very good officer. When he pulled up, we had three floors well involved with fire. We knew that he knew right away that there was going to be problems. He called for help right away. Did what we call a command officer recall for our department. So all of the command officers received a page to respond in. And before I got there, he had some things going. He was trying to get some master streams going, but as we dive further into this, the building was just a very unusual building, a bastard building that you really can't fight on multiple ends. So he was the first arriving boss, did what he could until we started to get some help there.
Gotcha. So you're talking about the building and all the issues with it. Can you tell us like kind of the construction type, you know, what the occupancy was and just a little bit more about that?
Yeah, the building was 73 by 222. So it spanned an entire city block. It was built in phases. It's a reinforced concrete building. If this building was built today, it would have to be, and I would say it's a type one. If it was built today, it would have had to have been sprinklered. You know, I mean, there just was no getting around it. But when it was built, the building was built in two phases. The first phase was a four-story with a large cock loft part that was built in 1899. And it was served as our city's power supply for the town power plant. And then they put an addition on 2 years later that was six stories that that served as a bicycle seat factory that was very prominent in the U.S., called the Troxell Bicycle Manufacturing Company. So through the years, though, it had different, all kinds of different occupancies. In the 60s, I'll go back a little bit, in the 50s and 60s, they tried to revitalize the fifth and sixth floors of the six-story part by putting fancy paneling in that, you know, would go with that vintage of that varnished or whatever paneling that burns readily. And then they put apartments in on the fourth floor. And the apartments, they have 21 apartments on the fourth floor of the complex. And then the top three floors in the 70s became bars and very popular place in town to go. It was called Uncle Vic's in the Mardi Gras Lounge. And it's a famous place for small town Elyria, Ohio. That's everybody knows when you talk about the building where it's at.
So this was a five or six story building.
The front part was six stories, mm-hmm. and then it went down. It went down to four,
gotcha.
four with a large cock loft.
Gotcha.
And through the years, it was just chopped up and renovated, and lots of voids.
So, what was the primary means of fire extension that you guys could tell? Was it just auto extension through?
Really, no. The there were four shafts in this building. Two large shafts on the six-story side and two on the four-story side. And those just served like chimneys to allow everything to go up. And then just rapid fire spread. The third floor, at the last time we had taken pictures as a fire department, you know, I don't know since then, but we had to assume err on the side of caution. The third floor was loaded with, you know, paint supplies, maintenance, just typical maintenance stuff.
Now, were there any partitions between the residential part? I'm assuming that was in the fourth story in the rear.
Yeah.
Was there any like firewall or partition or anything? No cordoned off.
No, it was. If you could picture, it was a large. The apartments were a large box in a box. Pretty much like a one-story group of apartment buildings underneath a large roof,
gotcha.
is the best way to describe it. And through the years, people were getting in. The building sat. I guess now would be a good time to try to explain it. And again, I encourage the listeners to, you'll put up some links to what the building looks like. But the building was pinched in a very tight alleyway. On one side, on the other side, on the north side, was a set of railroad tracks, elevated tracks with 67,000 volt lines coming in to feed the town. Over the years, the facade was starting to deteriorate. And I think at one time I passed on to Lex a picture of us in aerial. We went up in our bucket and you could scrape away, you know, the limestone that was holding the bricks together. So the building had been on my radar for a very long time.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm looking at an old black and white photo right now of when it was the Troxell Manufacturing Company. It looks like there was also some businesses on that first floor there, like in this case, it was a Western Auto and a dry cleaning.
So yeah.
It was almost like an old mixed-use type building back in the day, almost like what a strip mall would be now.
Yeah, it was a building that nobody could fill the whole thing, so they would chop it up into just pieces, parts. And the most, again, the last use was a large, lounge bar type place. So the new owner, you know, there was a new owner that came in and he wants to revitalize downtown. So I give him credit. He's a good person. And you just have to think that this building has all kinds of items that, you know, you're dealing with construction and old bars.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So go ahead and give us a rundown of your department's resources and basically capabilities to something of this magnitude.
Well, our on-duty strength every day in Elyria is 14. We run three engines and a truck, true truck, no tank, no pump. The truck carries four, and the engine companies carry three, and then we have a shift commander and a buggy. Elyria is a little rough because as far as mutual aid coming in, it's mutual aid. We are surrounded by smaller part-time departments that aren't always manned. They're very good departments, but they're not always staffed. Gotcha. And it takes us to get.
So what's that reflex time, do you think, on average? So we're talking 14. So you're talking 14 on duty, and then you got a reflex time of automatic aid.
Yeah. Our first mutual aid companies coming in are roughly 10 to 15 minutes away. Gotcha. That we call. They're staffed. And depending on where the fire is in town, it's a good, you know, it could be a good 15 minutes. On this night, I would say the first truck company arrived about 15 minutes. So the reflex time for mutual aid, it can be in my city, it can be a while, but it actually kind of gives, for this kind of fire, gave us the ability to start thinking about where we wanted to go with our apparatus and set it up. Our county has nine truck companies or nine aerials, and we use seven of them. And some of the lessons learned, we get into it later, we'll talk about that. But it was probably, in my career, the largest event. We had a larger old mill manufacturing plant burn in 2008 when I was the chief of the department. And that took a lot of resources and had a lot of fire in it, but it didn't have the urgency because we had to save our downtown. We had flying brands. The alleyway that, again, I'll encourage the listeners to look up. The alleyway was 20 feet between that building that was burning and another group of buildings that were built after the Civil War, just after the Civil War, probably three of our oldest buildings in town. So we had those were ordinary construction, and we had that very narrow alleyway. We were hesitant on putting firefighters in the alleyway because of the deterioration of the building that was burning prior to the fire. So it was a very difficult fight. I really believed that we were going to lose, and I told city officials, mutual aid companies, I was very pessimistic, and I said, we're going to lose these buildings that were across the alleyway.
So what was the wind conditions that night, or weather?
The wind gusting up to about 25 miles per hour. The way that the wind was coming in, it was basically creating it was coming in from the northwest. It was basically pushing the causing all kinds of problems coming in over the elevated tracks where there was no buffering of the wind, and was just pushing the fire throughout. As you can see from some of the pictures that I showed you, it was quite, it rapidly spread. There was just no way that we could put firefighters in the building. It was just too big, too much fire, too many traps.
Mm-hmm. So back to the staffing real quick. You know, you talked about bringing the mutual aid departments in, and you had a command recall. Did you recall, like, your staffing of the department as well, the other shifts? Do they come in?
Yeah, we have what's called a general alarm recall, but I think out of a 52, 55-man fire department, we probably got an additional maybe 14 to 17 people total, but we also had another structure fire, an MVA, wires down. Everything that could go in your town was happening during this event. So we relied on mutual aid pretty extensively. I think at the height, I would not be surprised if we had 80 to 90 firefighters on scene.
So going back to the building, what would you say, as you were pre-planning and getting out there, were the biggest hazards or the things you were the most concerned with?
I think the biggest hazards were just the traps that I'll call that were in the building, just the open shafts, the maze-like layout of the building. I think the best way to describe it is I like to go back to there's a Deputy Chief Mike McNamee of Worcester, Massachusetts, was the deputy chief in charge at night where they lost six firefighters in 99. And I was reading a book about that fire, and I've seen his presentation, and he talks about how he was driving in off duty with his wife, and he had pointed at that building prior to the fire, and he says, that building right there, he was talking to his wife, that building there scares me. And that's how I always felt about this building. And you know, it unfortunately, you know, cost, you know, that they had the fire shortly after McNamee said that to his wife. And I've been saying that about this building. And it always stuck in my mind that there's going to be buildings in your town that should scare you. And you have to be prepared for. If you're in a big department, then they're in your running district or whatever. But if you're in a department like mine, that's small, you're in a small, you know, four or five or one station town or whatever, there's no excuse not to recognize these buildings, especially if you work in an urban, old industrial area like I do.
Can you talk about the issues that you're still currently experiencing, like with the hot spots? Can you explain kind of the construction that we're seeing and like some of these pictures that we're going to share online?
Yeah, you know, the biggest problem is the fourth floor that I mentioned. One of the things that we did that I never thought we would do, that was an old school tactic that you see in black and white pictures across the country, or I know all your listeners and you guys are buffs, is one of the things that we did, the incident commander, I'll back up a little bit. The incident commander, it was his shift. He was off. But when he came in, it was decided that this is your shift. You take command. And he is a very good IC. And I kind of took more of an operations spot. But early on, one of the things that he decided to do, which was great, was to stretch lines in that building. Those buildings I told you were across the alleyway. And we actually had 2.5s going from one building across the alley and into that building that was burning, into the Washington Towers building. And I never thought we would ever utilize that kind of old school tactic, but it worked. I mean, it was able to beat back the fire from coming into that building. And we actually we have three turns, three shifts, and the third shift assistant chief that showed up on a recall, we put him in charge of that exposure and putting those lines in service with mutual aid firefighters that have never been in the departments that he had. They don't quite have the buildings that we do. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. And they did an exceptional job for being unaware of the building and the types of construction and you know, those kind of things. That it was remarkable. And that assistant chief, his name's Kevin Zabo. He did an excellent job, and he saved that block of buildings across the alleyway by putting the 2.5s inside there.
Yeah. I'm actually watching the fire.
He's
right,
like,
here.
Watching the video. Okay. Of the fire.
So, yeah, I can definitely tell. Yeah, the fourth floor was definitely the problem floor there. So
yeah. And it still is, you know, Lexi had mentioned about what's happening now. So what's happening now is they started demolition of the building, but because it sits on railroad tracks, one side sits on railroad tracks, they can't get up onto the right of way. They got a small alley and these buildings on the other side. So they're just taking it bites at a time. And what's happening is those apartments with all the stuff that's inside is cooking. And when the wind catches just right over the open windows, it just flares up. And in fact, just right before we came on, we were there today. So, I mean, it's just, it's not a good thing, but we can't put people inside there. It's just not worth it.
Well, did you guys have any problems with water supply or did your
grid? Another lesson, don't tap your same main, couple things there. We were operating the way this building sits. The main cross street is our downtown main street, Broad Street. And the hydrants are good, but we also knew early on that if we started tapping, you know, from a couple hydrants, we would
we would lose water. We would suck, you know, we would be stealing. One of the things that I would like to recommend to your listeners that on Main Street fires or any kind of large fire, if you have the ability to call your water pumping plant, tell them to boost the pressure or get you more pressure in your lines, do that. That's always been kind of our thing here in my city to do that. Another thing that we did, once we had flying brands flying all over our downtown area, landing on these old type 3 buildings, we called for what we called a water shuttle. And there's a lot of departments in my county, Lorain County, Ohio, that they don't have hydrants and they're very good at moving water. And they'll set up dump tanks, dump ponds, and you just start and you just let them go because they're very good at doing that. And we ended up calling for our shuttle, and they did an excellent job. They were ready, but we had flying brands going all over the downtown.
So what specific tactics did you use for the flying brands as you get guys?
We had put an aerial up on that main drag of Broad Street over top of those vintage buildings that were on the other side of the alley. And they kind of kept those roofs wet. Then we did the same thing further downward. We had some flying brands. So when I had mentioned there are 9 aerials in the county and we had 7 of them there, we probably had 6 in service of the 7, either ready, you know, protecting from the brands or, you know, accessing the roofs of the other downtown buildings.
How far away were your brands going? I mean, are we talking like a block?
They were traveling probably from the fire building, I would say 200 feet away across this main drag onto other buildings across that street. So, I would say a good ways away that we could see. They're flying farther, but that's what we could see.
Was the aerial protection enough to prevent any extension to those other roofs or?
Yeah. We didn't have anything, any extension. Certainly I think that if we hadn't thought about it or were trying, you know, proactive in getting ahead of it, mm-hmm. we could have had a problem, but we were, once we saw what, you know, things built, I mentioned that the building had 4 shafts. So you had 4 shafts blowing fire out of this building and a lot of it. And so those 4 chimneys were throwing brands everywhere and we knew right away. So I would say as a lesson to share, be proactive when you have a large fire like that to anticipate flying brands and not wait.
So what could you tell us about this? Like your first initial apparatus, they arrive on scene and they have fire from 3 floors. What were their initial, was their initial thought process to protect the exposure building? Did they go straight into a deck gun attack? What was their, were their initial actions?
Yeah, because of the building size, 2 of our 3 engine companies approached it on one street, and then our Northside Engine Company, which would be 3rd due to the downtown area, they came up on the other street. And the initial from the captain that was riding up was, let's just try to knock this thing down quickly, at least try. Mm-hmm. But what he didn't see was on the north side of the tracks or on the north side of the building on the railroad tracks, it was moving. There wasn't anything that we could do. It was just a wide open area with a lot of stuff to burn.
So now you said the 4-story addition in the rear was residential. What did you guys do for the life hazard there? Was everyone reporting?
We had, well, I think, and again, my initial thought in talking to the assistant chief who ended up taking the IC was that if we can knock it down, we did have a report. There was a person that came in and we knew that vagrants were getting into the building beforehand. And we knew by the way the fire was that there was, and we'll get to that later, but it was so advanced. We knew that this was probably, you know, it wasn't accidental. There was no power, no gas to the building. So we ended up having a bystander come and came up to the command post and said, there's 2 kids that are inside there. And that kind of, that was not good. So my initial thought that I pass along to the IC is, let's try to knock this down. And, you know, we'll put together some crews to see about making a recon inside. But once we ended up getting a location on the two juveniles that were told to be inside, we kind of took relaxed things a little bit. It was just too much fire. And the building just held too many. If we just didn't think there would be any chance of survivability in this building if there were people inside. So we did think about it. You know, we did have a plan, but once we got that the two unaccounted juveniles were in police custody, we kind of backed off of that.
So as the scene progressed, you know, how can you talk to us about the collapse zones? Did you have any significant wall collapses, parapet collapses, anything like that that you had to account for?
Well, one of the things that caused us some worries was when I mentioned the four-story section in the 60s, because this building sat on railroad tracks, the constant vibration from the trains were causing the deterioration of the of that four-story building. So sometime in the 60s, early 70s, whoever owned it at the time put at least 100 to 150 2x4 shores in a cock loft to hold the concrete roof up. Our worry was, we knew they were there. Our worry was, and it always was, that if the fire got and took out those 2x4s, we're going to have a catastrophic collapse. A couple things that we did that were good lessons that I want to share was we utilized, in the state of Ohio, our urban search and rescue comes out of regions. Ohio is split up into regions. And our urban search and rescue for our region, before you'd get to Task Force One out of Columbus or wherever they're from, they have a structural engineer. So we called for that structural engineer. He's a real engineer. It was kind of funny because, again, one of the other things that I want to stress is you want to have a good rapport with your city officials. And it was kind of funny when I said, I need an engineer. They were going to call the city engineer. And I kind of joked to our safety director that I don't have a worry about the sewers. I got to worry about this building coming down. We all got a good laugh out of it. But when the structural engineer came, he was able to walk around. We told him that the building, one of the other problems was the pillars were wrapped in concrete. The columns were wrapped in concrete in the six-story section. In the four-story section, they were cast iron columns, which some had some type of covering on them. But as you got higher in the building and on that fourth, the attic where those 2x4 T-shores were, those cast iron columns were exposed, I should say. And I knew that, and I expressed that to the structural engineer. So as far as collapse, I don't think we were worried. We knew we had the barrier of the railroad trestle on the one side, on the north side. On the south side, we did have those buildings. But I think my biggest thought was, and always was, if this building burned, it would be a pancake type of collapse. Not that it was going to be any better, mm-hmm. but just based on the construction, that was our thought process.
So did the fire ever actually reach the four-story rear of the building?
As we speak, it's still cooking in those apartments that we can't get to. I never got to that cock loft where those T-shores are, we don't think. That was our biggest fear. And fortunately, it didn't. During the night of the fire, it didn't get up in there.
Okay. So I know one of the tactics you guys used at this fire was the technology, like the drone. Can you talk about that some?
Yeah, one of the things that I've always stressed, whether I was teaching or that I knew when they got them, was to utilize drones, utilize drone technology, make friends with your police department. A lot of police law enforcement agencies have these drones. They can do amazing things And a lot of law enforcement agencies have them. And I think one of the things is that, you know, many fire departments may not even know that their law enforcement agency has them. So make friends and ask if your law enforcement agency has them. But I was first kind of, if you would, turned on to drones. There was a fire near your old stomping grounds, Lex, in Putnam County, mm-hmm. Ohio. And there was a large fire in a downtown area. Some, I can't remember the exact city, but they ended up using drones. And the fire chief of that department had told me about it. And I then knew that my department had purchased drones. And so we made contact with them. I have many friends at the police department in my town. And we ended up, you know, working with them. And we used them at a bowling alley, a large bowling alley fire that we had in July. And I liked the technology. It was, you know, with especially law enforcement now has infrared, mm-hmm. and it may not see the, it may not be dialed into the same kind of heat that was one of the things that you see heat, you know where the fire is, and it's good to know where it's going with that, but you don't get an exact temperature. You know, these drones were not made, they were made to pick up our heat of our bodies so they could catch bad guys. But it's still, if you know that going in, you surely can find out where the fire is and where it's not. Mm-hmm. And the drones were a huge, huge help at this fire because it allowed us to see the heat on the, what we called the Robinson building, which was across the alley that Assistant Chief Zabo was trying to protect with the streams in the building, that we were able to see from the drones, you know, where it was getting warm on that building. And it provided us an incredible amount of recon. So if you have a drone in your law enforcement agency, use it. If they do, you know, my thing is utilize the resource. Don't try to, you know, we're going to go buy our own, because one of the things that was good was that the police department has 11 trained operators of these two drones. And so just about every working shift in the police department has guys that can operate the drones, and they know what they're doing. They play with them all the time. They know how to record them. And so they were getting information back to us, you know, right then and there. I'm watching on an iPad. So I highly recommend that.
Now, how did you go about deciding to use those? Was that something that you had pre-planned? If there had been a fire in that building, you knew you were going to call for that resource, or is that something you called for later on?
I knew right away. I knew I was going to call for them. I always have certain, like I said, the bowling alley fire in July, when we utilized the drones from our police department, it just, that was it. From then on, I knew that's what I was going to use for a large fire. And when I was going to the scene, I was already making phone calls, and they knew that I would be calling for it. So everybody was on the same page. But yeah, I recommend it for good commercial fires, especially when, if you don't have the resources like we don't in my town, in my county, that it tells you where to put your troops mm-hmm. from a safe location.
Right. So talking a little bit more about pre-planning, I know you said you guys had been out in this building and kind of the importance of that. You want to tell us some more about what you kind of found when you were doing that, and how you utilized that information?
Yeah, I know I'm preaching to the choir with you too, but for your listeners, get in your buildings, get in them, use your phone and take pictures. It doesn't have to be a fancy inspection or a fancy pre-plan. If your department doesn't have a pre-plan program and you're a company officer or a command officer of a department like my size, or, you know, a smaller department, hey, okay, you can't control everything, but you can control, you can use your phone, start taking pictures and build up your own inventory, and it paid off. I can't stress it enough that, you know, all three of us are in the sharing field, and a lot of times when you share stuff, a lot of people think, well, what have they done, or what's this guy done, or whatever. Well, I'm telling you, this is one time that I'm telling you it pays off. And it really made the fire ground slow down, because we knew at least I was able to convey to the IC and to others that may not have had the love affair that I had with the building, mm-hmm. to be careful. And that's what I had. I had an affair with that building to where I knew that if we had a fire in it, it would be trouble. And I feel that we were successful because they're always saying, Prunesti's talking about this building, Prunesti's talking about that building, this, and it pays off. It pays off.
Absolutely. So what would you say are the biggest lessons you learned from this fire?
I think first and foremost is to get in your buildings, especially if you have a downtown or Main Street. That's where you're going to lose. Listen, the mayor and my safety director do not come to every working house fire we have in the city of Elyria. The mayor and your safety directors of those that are listening to this know that they're not probably going to come to every house fire in your city, but they do go to the big ones. And when you have a fire in a residential dwelling, it's sad and it's bad and it's critical for the, you know, it's a bad time for the person that's having that emergency, mm-hmm. but then it's over. You burn a block of buildings down in your main street, all eyes are on you. All eyes are on you. And you can either be prepared and save building, or you can lose a block. And I've seen it go both ways. I've participated in both ways. And the more you know about the building, the better the chance you have to save it or save the other structures. That was the other thing. We knew the buildings that we were worried about it spreading to. We knew how to access the cockloft of those buildings. We knew, you know, where to get in and the voids and everything. So it pays off.
I was going to say, you had let me know that there was a fire going on in your city, and as someone, an outsider listening to that fire, that was one of the most calm radio traffics that I've heard from a fire scene that size. So kudos to you, because you guys could absolutely tell that you knew exactly where those buildings were. And I'm pretty sure it was you it told someone exactly how to access, you know, a cockloft space in the building next door. And I'm like, those are people who know their buildings, right? Like, how much time would a department spend searching for that area if they're not out in them?
Yeah, and it just pays off. And I'm a believer in that. And you always have to pretend. I think somebody, maybe it was you, you put on one of your Instagrams or something, that you always have to pretend that there's a fire in the building, or always when you're passing a fire, and you have to be like that. You have to. I've always been like that, and it's just the way you have to be successful. And as far as communications, I will say this, that I think we were sometimes overwhelmed. One of the things that we probably should have done earlier that we did not do, when I first got on scene and the other assistant chief arrived off duty on scene, we both arrived about the same time. And that's when we made the decision that he would take command of the fire. We took the captain that was originally in charge of the shift that night. He took us a division. But one of the things that we should have done, I sort of started acting like his aide at first, mm-hmm. and was trying to get mutual aid going and was talking on our main dispatch channel, and he was focusing on the fire and the tack. But then I kind of branched off into an operations role, and it left that IC. I made a mistake of just kind of leaving that IC alone, and he needed an aide. And if you are a small town fire department that doesn't have an aide, or you have a large Main Street type of fire or a large commercial building fire, find somebody. They don't have to arrive with you right away, but get somebody that can talk on the radio, that can write things down, that can talk to you. The command post got overwhelmed with people and people coming up to the IC, and it can be overwhelming, and you have to get an aide there. I think that was one thing that I also want to share, because we ended up going to another thing that we did well that I will recommend is that we did utilize multiple TAC channels. We had the exposure, the other assistant chief that was protecting the exposure, Kevin Zabo, he was on a separate TAC. We had the water shuttle, the guys that were dumping, they were on a different TAC. And then our EMA director brought myself and the IC UHF radios that only him and I could hear and monitor. And that was good because as I was moving around the structure, which again was a block long, I was able just to go directly. We basically created like a command channel, and we were able to be specific. We could have a long-winded conversation, and it didn't tie in any emergencies or anything like that.
So how did y'all guys implement the clap zone with such close proximity?
Yeah, that was the other thing that I'm very proud of my department for, is that the first arriving, our truck spotted on a corner, because you want to spot almost, you know, you want to flank. Vinny Dunn has taught us all, you want to flank. And that first in truck company of ours, that officer flanked the building. The mutual aid company, they were fantastic. Nobody told them to do this, but they were set up on the sixth story. So our first arriving mutual aid truck set up on the sixth story side. They backed from our main street. They backed down and flanked the building, but they backed down so they could get their aerial set up in a position where they had full scrub area or whatever you want to call it to access. The mutual aid, you know, like I said, everybody stayed as well as out of the collapse zone as we possibly could. We had a good safety officer that night. Our training officer is a 40-hour, works a 40-hour shift, and he responds after hours and is our safety officer. Shout out to him. He did a great job. Yeah, he had to walk lots of blocks. I think that was the other thing we probably should have done is maybe establish a couple safety officers, but we just ran out of people. We just ran out of command officers to put into those places. And you do need command officers or command level officers to put into spots where you have to tell people no, where you're going to have to put people no. I'm a firm believer in having a command officer because they like telling people no.
So you said you had quite a bit of endemic, you know, information about the building, which is obviously good. So now, how did that affect your foreseeability and how the fire spread? Did it go as you would have thought it would, since you knew about the shafts, or did it do something that you didn't think it would do?
Well, I'll be honest with you. Here was the fire that I was worried about. The fire right now, there's two juveniles that are in question that were arrested and charged that were in the building that admitted that they were messing around in there. But that said, I knew that there were squatters or people getting into that building way before the fire. And I always worried about a smoldering fire where we pull up and we just got smoke showing. That's where we would have had to stretch lines and go inside. And it just becomes a maze of, it becomes a fun house, unfortunately, of traps for our people. So that was a fire that always would scare the heck out of me. This one, I mean, the fire, it was right there, and the building behaved just like we knew it would with that fire. So I'm actually happy that the fire was like that and not what I worried about, where we would pull up and maybe have some smoke showing and we would have to send crews in to this dark, ginormous building to try to find a fire. That would have been bad news.
So tell us about some previous fires in this building.
Well, there was a fire. There was one fire, and that's the if you read some media accounts, and this building again holds a special place in my heart because it was the first fire I remember going to. It was July 23rd, 1976. Yes, Lex and you two both probably were not alive then. No, I know. But I was 6 years old. My father was on a job for 30 years in Elyria, and he was home, and he called in everybody. And my sisters took me to the fire. And at that time, that fire was the nightmare fire that I worried about. Fire started in a shaft, one of the shafts, and it filled the building with smoke. And the fire extended on each floor, but it never got more than 10 feet out from the shaft. So they did have fire in the building, but they had an awful lot of smoke. Mm-hmm. And there was, he ended up being one of my assistant chiefs when I came on the job. He was a firefighter at the time. And him and another firefighter were on the fourth floor. At that time, the building was occupied and there were people in the apartments. So they had a real problem when they arrived on that day. And they were trying to get searching those apartments and they ran out of air. And there's glass block windows. And they had to bust out a glass block window to get help. And some of the photos that you may have seen or whatever, they put the only time that they ever said they put it up at a fire. And the reason why we carry it still is we have some tight alleyways, especially in our downtown, and we carry a banger on our truck still. And that they put a banger up to rescue those two firemen. And so one of the things that I always would do with my guys is when I got into a position where I could do this, we would put the banger up in this alley that this building sat on. And I always said, this is why we carry a banger. This is where you might have to put it up, that this banger ladder set, you know, saved two firefighters. But that building, there was so much smoke and so much heat, and the heat of the day itself, 17 firefighters went to the hospital. And, you know, back then they didn't have the SCBAs that we have now. They had masks, but not enough. And the guys took a beating. And, you know, my dad was one of them. So I always remember that fire. It was, and I got bit by the bug from that day on. There was another captain, and I'll stop now, but I'm going to give him a shout out. He's 93 years old now. His name is Ray Pulaski. And Captain Ray was all over that building. And I just remember as a kid, he didn't have a coat on, just had his boots, no helmet. He had a crew cut, and he was everywhere. Back when he could be everywhere. And that's when I said I wanted to be a fireman. I wanted to be like my dad, but Captain Ray, he had a cooler haircut than my dad.
So that's cool you talk about the banger ladder and the tight access. Now, would that have been applicable here on the railroad side where that rail line runs along there? If you had someone hanging out of the windows, that's about your only play there, correct?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I will send you one of the pictures from 1976 is a rescue along the tracks. They took a 35-foot ladder that afternoon, dragged it up onto the tracks to rescue somebody from the fourth floor apartments. And on the front page of our local newspaper is a picture of that firefighter. His name was Ken Redinger, on a 35 rescuing a guy off the railroad tracks. Wow. So, you know, back then the rescues were heroic. There was a lot of guys that went to the hospital. Almost lost a few guys there. If we had to do it again today, I don't think we would have had the amount of people. They had 21 men on duty back in the 70s with five engine companies and a snorkel and a rescue truck. We had three engines and a truck showing up. So a lot different staffing wise. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't be able to put the ladders in service or anything. But the lesson here is if you have a downtown, you have alleys, you got to learn how to throw ladders in those alleys to save people. Did we have to do it 10 days ago? No, thank God we didn't. But we still have a huge downtown district that we got to protect. So you got to know how to throw those ladders. Not too many people have banger ladders anymore.
Yeah. What's your height of your bangers?
40. It's a 45, I believe.
45. Awesome. Cool.
So
talking about the Main Street buildings you have left, is there anything that you learned from this fire specifically that you would maybe do differently should another building?
Yeah, a couple things that lessons for us, command and control is one of problems. This is one of my problems, personal problems that I have to work on. Well, it's probably too late after being on 32 years, but one of my problems is you get into a habit of picking up that microphone and just giving orders. Engine one, I need you to blah, 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 blah. Engine three, I need you to blah, 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 blah. And you never give that time for that reply back. There was a little bit of an issue at this fire. So we just today actually also reviewed a line of duty death from Toledo that Battalion Chief Mike Benedum gives. And one of the things he brings up is the ability to allow, you know, repeat it back, give a quick regurgitation back of what you want done, or, you know, say engine three, lay a line to the second floor, engine three, lay a line, second floor. Sometimes we say, well, you don't want all that superfluous radio traffic, but when you have a serious event, you want to do that. So the communications aspect, I think the other thing is everything else, I will say that in my 32 years, I've been, I don't know if you want to call it lucky, we have had a lot of major events for a city our size. You know, we're 56,000 people, but we are a busy department. And throughout my career, we have had major events, major chemical explosions, evacuating 5,000 people at one. We've had train derailments. What I guess I'm saying is that we've had a lot of issues in my career. This one, without a doubt, was the best run emergency event that I've been a part of that has been this big. And that includes a fire when I was chief that I told you about, the mill complex. This fire, you know, again, a few things here and there, communication issues, with, you know, one. But other than that, the lessons are more a success. Know your buildings. You have to understand your buildings and things will run smoother.
So during something like, you know, this high fidelity, I guess, command, burden that you had. Now, where was your command post set up? Was it kind of in the distance in like a mobile command unit?
Because this building was so big, the command was set up basically at this building. The main intersection of our town is Broad Street. This building sat behind a building that fronted Broad Street that we were talking about protecting, but it sat between two other streets. And so you couldn't see everything. So the initial IC that captain set himself up to, he could just see the one side. And that's basically where we kept the command post. But we had mutual aid chiefs. That's the other thing, that we had mutual aid chiefs come in that they were phenomenal. They did an excellent job. We told them what we wanted. They knew. The one mutual aid chief lives in the city, even though he's the chief of a mutual aid department that comes in regularly into the city. But he's been around long enough. He knows the city better than some of our guys. And he knew that building. So it was very easy. The other mutual aid chief used to be on our department. And so he knew the building. He knew the layout. He knew the water supply. So that part worked out. But the lesson here is, if you are a small town chief or a small town department, make friends with your chiefs that surround you and be ready to call them and have boxes or ability to recall them and put them to work. We would joke around that some fires in our community or in our county, you know, you see more white hats than firefighters, and, you know, it's a kitchen fire. Okay. But you know what? When you have a large commercial building, you need those white hats to keep the building safe or keep the firefighters safe and to be your eyes and ears to get the information back. It paid off dividends.
So essentially you had, we'll call it like a remote command post, but then you had a chief kind of stationed on multiple sides of the building.
Yeah, we had, the other problem that we had that I wanted to bring up, it wasn't a problem because it was successful. The IC that ended up taking over, one of the things that him and I discussed very quickly, again, when we arrived at the same time, was I said, we got to get on the same page and tell everybody what we're calling the sides of the structure. Mm-hmm. So we called where his command post was set up, the main draggable area is called Broad Street. Well, it would be the side that was facing that alley that I keep talking about. That was the A side. There was no action going on in the A side because we weren't letting people in that alley. So then the B side it had an address. So if you were just looking at this building, you would think that would be the A side, but it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And then the C side was the tracks, and way on the other side of the block was the D side, where the six-story section was. Mm-hmm. And so we had to make it known. So one of the things that we did right away to recommend is to do that, is to make known the sides of the building, say it out over radio, and we put chiefs on. We had the first arriving captain took the B side, but the C side and D side were mutual aid chiefs.
So now having the street-based command, I guess, system, do you think that was ever overwhelmed or in somewhat negatively affected by the scene itself, opposed to being in a command post? How did that kind of play out?
Well, the we try to maintain our command in Elyria in our command buggy. That'll be for another podcast, another discussion. You can have somebody else on to talk about that. But I've run fires both ways. I've run fires in my career running around the building like a madman with a portable. And now, probably in the last 10 years, I've run fires from the car. I will never go back, just the way I am. I will never go back to running around the building with a portable radio. If that means, though, we have to get good reports and we have to put people, when you have a larger building, you got to put people in the right spots to give you good information. So not having the IC in a command post like we did in our assistant chief's car or buggy, that proved it. He was secluded. We even brought in our giant EMA emergency management agency as this big ginormous bus, this command post that you can talk to Mars on. I asked the IC, I said, do you want to come in here? He goes, no. He says, just leave me alone in this car. I got the radios. I got you guys giving me information. And he parked we parked the big giant command post right by the buggy. So he could actually look in the windows and we could communicate with our hands and everything to him if we needed to. So you got to be quiet. You got to have a quiet spot. And I think that type of command post is the way to go.
Is there anything else that you can think of that you want the listeners to know about this fire, or maybe one of their
messages? No, I think we may do a little article on it in the future for probably Firefighter Nation or Fire Engineering. But the big one is to, I think, know your buildings, get in them, understand how fire's going to react in them, play act in your head, burn those buildings in your head 1,000 times and anticipate bad things to your buildings and prepare that way. So it all paid off. There's no doubt in my mind it paid off. We did not lose any other buildings. And again, when your listeners see some of the pictures and the area and the alleyway that separated other buildings, I'm very proud of my department and all the mutual aid. I couldn't be prouder.
Did you come out of the night with no injuries and stuff as well to the firefighters?
Yeah, no injuries. Nobody got hurt, not even a hangnail or a twisted ankle. Everybody was good, and that was a plus. I mean, there was nothing for the – we have a private ambulance company that does EMS, and they didn't have to do anything. They sat in the park across the street and stood by.
What is there any determination yet on the cause?
Kids playing around. That's about all right now.
They think like multiple origins or just?
I don't know. I'll leave that for the cops. Yeah, we'll never find out. We'll never, I don't think, pinpoint. So I don't want to really speculate, but I will say that we knew that kids, not kids, but the other thing that I just heard of today that maybe your listeners know, I guess it's a big city thing. They're called urban explorers something.
Yeah, very common. We've had a lot of, we've had them kids come across barrels of flammable stuff and actually have some catastrophic shaft fires. And I think one of them actually was fatal. So
I guess kids, if you have vacant buildings, there's a whole YouTube channel devoted to going through buildings with your phone and just taking pictures or whatever, video. And so it becomes a challenge. No matter what this owner did, so I don't fault the owner at all. This building was just ginormous. And every time he would secure it, because people could come up onto the tracks. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of homeless. We have a lot of vacant buildings in our town. We have a lot of explorers. So no matter what this guy did, and he always stayed up on it, I mean, they would just knock out a window, jump across the tracks, and jump right into the building. So
now, what was the building also in a state of disrepair to where people like copper thieves and vandals and like that nature also, or was it kind of mostly put together still just empty?
The building had vandalism to it. There was evidence that there was people in there. It was gaining momentum. More and more people were, I would say, in my opinion, getting into the building in the last year or two than previous years. They would come in off the railroad tracks. One night
It made the front page of our local newspaper. A bunch of kids pushed a shopping cart full of paint off the fifth floor window. And so we knew. And like I may have mentioned before, I felt bad because the owner was trying to board, you know, it just was a massive building. It was a game to try to get inside.
And that goes to the point that a lot of people don't realize is in these older buildings like this that have been vandalized, a lot of the safety measures get, you know, taken away, obviously, like hand railings around open pits and stair railings and that kind of thing. So something that people don't realize just makes a dangerous building even more dangerous.
Yeah, one of the things, too, that the owner, I don't know if the owner did, but I remember seeing companies or, you know, people in there scrapping. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a big business. Mm-hmm. And we have to think about that on our buildings, that, you know, that's a profit that somebody, it buys a property, they can make money by having somebody come in and scrap it. Well, they're basically destructing the building. They're destroying the building and ripping everything out. They know it's coming down, or they know it's vacant. They're not going to be careful about ripping things out. So now it just becomes more holes and more voids. So that's another good lesson about this fire too, is that if you've got these vacant buildings and someone is taking, you know, possession, they may have somebody come in and scrap.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Chief. We really appreciate you taking your time and sharing your story with us. And if anyone wants to reach out to you with questions, you and sharing your contact information.
Sure, no problem. My email is the best way to get a hold of me. It's EFD, Edward Frank Dog, EFD, like Elyria Fire Department, Chief 3, CHIEF3 at Outlook.com.
Awesome. Thanks again, Chief. We really appreciate it.
Thanks. Keep up the good work, guys.
As we close out tonight, we'd again like to thank Fire Engineering for hosting this series and Chief Pernesti for taking time out of his schedule to share the story of his fire. As he referenced in the interview, please feel free to visit Fire Engineering's website for more photos and additional information on this fire. If there are certain topics you'd like to hear more on or a fire you'd like to discuss, please reach out. As always, stay safe and have a good night.